Chapter 13, 1756, 1757. Partisan War. Shirley's grand scheme for cutting New France in twain had come to wreck. There was an element of boyishness in him. He made bold plans without weighing too closely his means of executing them. The year's campaign would in all likelihood have succeeded, if he could have acted promptly, if he had had ready to his hand a well-trained and well-officered force, furnished with material of war and means of transportation, and prepared to move as soon as the streams and lakes of New York were open, while those of Canada were still sealed with ice. But timely action was out of his power. The army that should have moved in April was not ready to move till August. Of the 9 discordant semi-republics whom he asked to join in the work, 3 or 4 refused, some of the others were lukewarm, and all were slow. Even Massachusetts, usually the foremost, failed to get all her men into the field till the season was nearly ended. Having no military establishment, the colonies were forced to improvise a new army for every campaign. Each of them watched its neighbors, or, jealous, lest it should do more than its just share, waited for them to begin. Each popular assembly acted under the eye of a frugal constituency, who, having little money, were as chary of it as their descendants are lavish, and most of them were shaken by internal conflicts, more absorbing than the great question in which hung the fate of the continent. Only the 4 New England colonies were fully earnest for the war, and one, even of these, was ready to use the crisis as a means of extorting concessions from its governor in return for grants of money and men. When the lagging contingents came together at last, under a commander who none of them trusted, they were met by strategical difficulties which would have perplexed older soldiers and an abler general, for they were forced to act on the circumference of a vast semicircle, in a labyrinth of forests, without roads, and choked with every kind of obstruction. Opposed to them was a trained army, well organized and commanded, focused at Montreal, and moving for attack or defense into radiating lines, one towards Lake Ontario, and the other towards Lake Champlain, supported by a martial peasantry, supplied from France with money and material, dependent on no popular vote, having no will but that of its chief, and ready in the instant to strike to right or left, as the need required. It was a compact military absolutism confronting a heterogeneous group of industrial democracies, where the force of numbers was neutralized by diffusion and incoherence. A long and dismal apprenticeship waited them, before they could hope for success, nor could they ever put forth their full strength without a radical change of political conditions and an awakened consciousness of common interests and a common cause. It was the sense of powerlessness arising from the want of union that, after the fall of Oswego, spread alarm through the northern and middle colonies, and drew these desponding words from William Livingston, of New Jersey: "The colonies are nearly exhausted, and their funds already anticipated by expansive and executed projects. Jealous are they of each other, some ill-constituted, others shaken with intestine divisions, and, if I may be allowed the expression, parsimonious even to prodigality. Our assemblies are diffident of their governors, governors despise their assemblies, and both mutually misrepresent each other to the court of Great Britain. Military measures," he proceeds, "demand secrecy and despatch, but when so many divided provinces must agree to join in them, secrecy and despatch are impossible." In conclusion he exclaims, "Canada must be demolished, delineist Cartago, or we are undone." But Loudon was not Scipio, and cisatlantic Carthage was to stand for some time longer. The Earl, in search of a scapegoat for the loss of Oswego, naturally chose Shirley, attacked him savagely, told him that he was of no use in America, and ordered him to go home to England without delay. Shirley, who was then in Boston, answered this indecency with dignity and effect. The chief fault was with Loudon himself, whose late arrival in America had caused a change of command and of plans in the crisis of the campaign. Shirley well knew the weakness of Oswego, and in early spring had sent two engineers to make it defensible, with particular instructions to strengthen Fort Ontario. But they, thinking that the chief danger lay on the west and south, turned all their attention thither, and neglected Ontario till it was too late. Shirley was about to reinforce Oswego with a strong body of troops when the arrival of Abercrombie took the control out of his hands and caused ruinous delay. He cannot, however, be acquitted of mismanagement in failing to supply the place with wholesome provisions in the preceding autumn, before the streams were stopped with ice. Hence came the ravages of disease and famine which, before spring, reduced the garrison to 140 effective men. Yet there can be no doubt that the change of command was a blunder. This is the view of Franklin, who knew Shirley well, and thus speaks of him: "He would, in my opinion, if continued in place, have made a much better campaign than that of Loudon, which was frivolous, expensive, and disgraceful to our nation beyond conception." For, though Shirley was not bred a soldier, he was sensible and sagacious in himself, and attentive to good advice from others, capable of forming judicious plans, and quick and active in carrying them into execution. He sailed for England in the autumn, disappointed and poor. The bull-headed Duke of Cumberland had been deeply prejudiced against him, and it was only after long waiting that the strenuous champion of British interests was rewarded in his old age with the petty government of the Bahamas. Loudon had now about 10,000 men at his command, though not all fit for duty. They were posted from Albany to Lake George. The Earl himself was at Fort Edward, while about 3,000 of the provincials still lay, under Winslow, at the lake. Montcalm faced them at Ticonderoga, with 5,300 regulars and Canadians, in a position where they could defy three times their number. "The sons of Balliol are too strong for me," jocosely wrote Winslow, and he set himself to entrenching his camp, then had the forest cut down for the space of a mile from the lake to the mountains, so that the trees, lying in what he calls a promiscuous manner, formed an almost impenetrable abattis. An escaped prisoner told him that the French were coming to visit him with 14,000 men, but Montcalm thought no more of stirring than Loudon himself, and each stood watching the other, with the lake between them, till the season closed. Meanwhile the western borders were still ravaged by the tomahawk. New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia all writhed under the infliction. Each had made a chain of blockhouses and wooden forts to cover its frontier, and manned them with disorderly bands, lawless, and almost beyond control. The case was at the worst in Pennsylvania, where the tedious quarreling of governor and assembly, joined to the doggedly pacific attitude of the Quakers, made vigorous defense impossible. Rewards were offered for prisoners and scalps, so bountiful that the hunting of men would have been a profitable vocation, but for the extreme wariness and agility of the game. Some of the forts were well-built stockades, others were almost worthless, but the enemy rarely molested even the feeblest of them, preferring to ravage the lonely and unprotected farms. There were two or three exceptions. A Virginian fort was attacked by a war party under an officer named Dougal, who was killed, and his followers were put to flight. The assailants were more fortunate at a small stockade called Fort Granville, in the Juniata. A large body of French and Indians attacked it in August, while most of the garrison were absent protecting the farmers at their harvest. They set it on fire, and, in spite of the most gallant resistance by the young lieutenant left in command, took it, and killed all but one of the defenders. What sort of resistance the Pennsylvanian borderers would have made under political circumstances less adverse may be inferred from an exploit of Colonel John Armstrong, a settler of Cumberland. After the loss of Fort Granville, the governor of the province sent him with 300 men to attack the Delaware town of Kittanning, a populous nest of savages in the Allegheny, between the two French posts of Duquesne and Venango. Here most of the war parties were fitted out, and the place was full of stores and munitions furnished by the French. Here, too, lived the redoubted chief called Captain Jacobs, the terror of the English border. Armstrong set out from Fort Shirley, the farthest outpost, in the last of August, and, a week after, was within 6 miles of the Indian town. By rapid marching and rare good luck, his party had escaped discovery. It was 10 o'clock at night, with a bright moon. The guides were perplexed, and knew neither the exact position of the place nor the paths that led to it. The adventurers threaded the forest in single file, over hills and through hollows, bewildered and anxious, stopping to watch and listen. At length they heard in the distance the beating of an Indian drum and the whooping of warriors in the war dance. Guided by the sounds, they cautiously moved forward, till those in the front, scrambling down a rocky hill, found themselves on the banks of the Allegheny, about 100 rods below Kittanning. The moon was near setting, but they could dimly see the town beyond a great intervening field of corn. At that moment, says Armstrong, an Indian whistled in a very singular manner, about 30 perches from our front, in the foot of the cornfield. He thought they were discovered, but one baker, a soldier well versed in Indian ways, told him that it was only some village gallant calling to a young squaw. The party then crouched in the bushes, and kept silent. The moon sank behind the woods, and fires soon glimmered through the field, kindled to drive off mosquitoes by some of the Indians who, as the night was warm, had come out to sleep in the open air. The eastern sky began to redden with the approach of day. Many of the party, spent with a rough march of 30 miles, had fallen asleep. They were now cautiously roused, and Armstrong ordered nearly half of them to make their way along the ridge of a bushy hill that overlooked the town, till they came opposite to it, in order to place it between two fires. 20 minutes were allowed them for the movement, but they lost their way in the dusk, and reached their station too late. When the time had expired, Armstrong gave the signal to those left with him, who dashed into the cornfield, shooting down the astonished savages or driving them into the village, where they turned and made desperate fight. It was a cluster of 30 log cabins, the principal being that of the chief, Jacobs, which was loopholed for musketry, and became the center of resistance. The fight was hot and stubborn. Armstrong ordered the town to be set on fire, which was done, though not without loss, for the Delawares at this time were commonly armed with rifles, and used them well. Armstrong himself was hit in the shoulder. As the flames rose and the smoke grew thick, a warrior in one of the houses sang his death song, and a squaw in the same house was heard to cry and scream. Rough voices silenced her, and then the inmates burst out, but were instantly killed. The fire caught the house of Jacobs, who, trying to escape through an opening in the roof, was shot dead. Bands of Indians were gathering beyond the river, firing from the other bank, and even crossing to help their comrades, but the assailants held to their work till the whole place was destroyed. During the burning of the houses, says Armstrong, we were agreeably entertained by the quick succession of charged guns, gradually firing off, as reached by the fire, but much more so with the vast explosion of sundry bags and large bags of gunpowder, wherewith almost every house abounded, the prisoners afterwards informing us that the Indians had frequently said they had a sufficient stock of ammunition for 10 years' war with the English. These prisoners were 11 men, women, and children, captured in the border settlements, and now delivered by their countrymen. The day was far spent, when the party withdrew, carrying their wounded in Indian horses, and moving perforce with extreme slowness, though expecting an attack every moment. None took place, and they reached the settlements at last, having bought their success with the loss of 17 killed and 13 wounded. A medal was given to each officer, not by the Quaker-ridden assembly, but by the City Council of Philadelphia. The report of this affair made by Dumas, commandant at Fort Duquesne, is worth noting. He says that Attique, the French name of Kittening, was attacked by a General Wichenden, with 300 or 400 men on horseback, that the Indians gave way, but that 5 or 6 Frenchmen who were in the town held the English in check till the fugitives rallied, that Washington and his men then took to flight, and would have been pursued but for the loss of some barrels of gunpowder which chanced to explode during the action. Dumas adds that several large parties are now on the track of the enemy, and he hopes will cut them to pieces. He then asks for a supply of provisions and merchandise to replace those which the Indians of Attique had lost by a fire. Like other officers of the day, he would admit nothing but successes in the department under his command. Dahlgren wrote singular dispatches at this time to the Minister of Versailles. He takes credit to himself for the number of war parties that his officers kept always at work, and fills page after page with details of the coups they had struck, how one brought in 2 English scalps, another 3, another 1, and another 7. He owns that they committed frightful cruelties, mutilating and sometimes burning their prisoners, but he expresses no regret, and probably felt none, since he declares that the object of this murderous warfare was to punish the English till they longed for peace. The waters and mountains of Lake George, and not the western borders, were the chief center of partisan war. Ticonderoga was a hornet's nest, pouring out swarms of savages to infest the highways and byways of the wilderness. The English at Fort William Henry, having few Indians, could not retort in kind, but they kept their scouts and rangers in active movement. What they most coveted was prisoners, as sources of information. One Kennedy, a lieutenant of provincials, with 5 followers, white and red, made a march of rare audacity, passed all the French posts, took a scalp and 2 prisoners in the Richelieu, and burned a magazine of provisions between Montreal and St. John. The party were near famishing on the way back, and Kennedy was brought into Fort William Henry in a state of temporary insanity from starvation. Other provincial officers, Peabody, Hezen, Waterbury, and Miller, won a certain distinction in this adventurous service, though few were so conspicuous as the blunt and sturdy Israel Putnam. Winslow writes in October that he has just returned from the best scout yet made, and that, being a man of strict truth, he may be entirely trusted.
Putnam had gone with 6 followers down Lake George in a whaleboat to a point in the east side, opposite the present village of Rigg, hid the boat, crossed northeasterly to Lake Champlain, 3 miles from the French fort, climbed the mountain that overlooks it, and made a complete reconnaissance, then approached it, chased 3 Frenchmen, who escaped within the lines, climbed the mountain again, and moving westward along the ridge, made a minute survey of every outpost between the fort and Lake George. These adventures were not always fortunate. In the 19th of September, Captain Hodges and 50 men were ambushed a few miles from Fort William Henry by thrice their number of Canadians and Indians, and only 6 escaped. Thus the record stands in the letter book of Winslow. By visiting the encampments of Ticonderoga, one may learn how the blow was struck. After much persuasion, much feasting, and much consumption of tobacco and brandy, 400 Indians, Christians from the missions and even from the far west, were persuaded to go on a grand war party with the Canadians. Of these last there were 100, a wild crew, bedecked and bedaubed like their Indian companions. Carrier, an officer of colony regulars, had nominal command of the whole, and among the leaders of the Canadians was the famous bushfighter, Marin. Bougainville was also of the party. In the evening of the 16th they all embarked in canoes at the French advance post commanded by Contrecoeur, near the present steamboat landing, passed in the gloom under the bare steeps of Rogers Rock, paddled a few hours, landed in the west shore, and sent scouts to reconnoiter. These came back with their reports in the next day, and an Indian crier called the chiefs to council. Bougainville describes them, as they stalked gravely to the place of meeting, wrapped in colored blankets, with lances in their hands. The accomplished young aide de camp studied his strange companions with an interest not unmixed with disgust. Of all caprice, he says, Indian caprice is the most capricious. They were insolent to the French, made rules for them which they did not observe themselves, and compelled the whole party to move when and whither they pleased. Hiding the canoes, and lying close in the forest by day, they all held their nocturnal course southward, by the lofty heights of Black Mountain, and among the islets of the Narrows, till the 18th. That night the Indian scouts reported that they had seen the fires of an encampment on the west shore, in which the whole party advanced to the attack, an hour before dawn, filing silently under the dark arches of the forest, the Indians nearly naked, and streaked with their war paint of vermilion and soot. When they reached the spot they found only the smoldering fires of a deserted bivouac. Then there was a consultation, ending, after much dispute, with the choice by the Indians of 110 of their most active warriors to attempt some stroke in the neighborhood of the English fort. Marin joined them with 30 Canadians, and they set out on their errand, while the rest encamped to await the result. At night the adventurers returned, raising the death cry and firing their guns, somewhat depressed by losses they had suffered, but boasting that they had surprised 53 English, and killed or taken all but one. It was a modest and perhaps an involuntary exaggeration. The very recital of the cruelties they committed in the battlefield is horrible, writes Bougainville. The ferocity and insolence of these black-souled barbarians makes one shudder. It is an abominable kind of war. The air one breathes is contagious of insensibility and hardness. This was but one of the many such parties sent out from Ticonderoga this year. Early in September a band of New England Rangers came to Winslow's camp, with 3 prisoners taken within the lines of Ticonderoga. Their captain was Robert Rogers, of New Hampshire, a strong, well-knit figure, in dress and appearance more woodsman than soldier, with a clear, bold eye, and features that would have been good but for the ungainly proportions of the nose. He had passed his boyhood in the rough surroundings of a frontier's village. Growing to manhood, he engaged in some occupation which, he says, led him to frequent journeyings in the wilderness between the French and English settlements, and gave him a good knowledge of both. It taught him also to speak a little French. He does not disclose the nature of this mysterious employment, but there can be little doubt that it was a smuggling trade with Canada. His character leaves much to be desired. He had been charged with forgery, or complicity in it, seems to have had no scruple in matters of business, and after the war was accused of treasonable dealings with the French and Spaniards in the West. He was ambitious and violent, yet able in more ways than one, by no means uneducated, and so skilled in woodcraft, so energetic and resolute, that his services were invaluable. In recounting his own adventures, his style is direct, simple, without boasting, and to all appearance without exaggeration. During the past summer he had raised a band of men, chiefly New Hampshire borderers, and made a series of daring excursions which gave him a prominent place in this hardy byplay of war. In the spring of the present year he raised another company, and was commissioned as its captain, with his brother Richard as his first lieutenant, and the intrepid John Stark as his second. In July still another company was formed, and Richard Rogers was promoted to command it. Before the following spring there were 7 such, and more were afterwards added, forming a battalion dispersed on various service, but all under the orders of Robert Rogers, with the rank of major. These rangers wore a sort of woodland uniform, which varied in the different companies, and were armed with smoothbore guns, loaded with buckshot, bullets, or sometimes both. The best of them were commonly employed in Lake George, and nothing can surpass the adventurous hardihood of their lives. Summer and winter, day and night, were alike to them. Embarked in whaleboats or birch canoes, they glided under the silent Nore in the languid glare of a breathless August day, when islands floated in dreamy haze, and the hot air was thick with odors of the pine ore in the bright October, when the jay screamed from the woods, squirrels gathered their winter hoard, and congregated blackbirds chattered farewell to their summer haunts, when gay mountains basked in light, maples dropped leaves of rustling gold, sumacs glowed like rubies under the dark green of the unchanging spruce, and mossed rocks, with all their painted plumage, lay double in the watery mirror, that festal evening of the year, when jocund nature disrobes herself, to wake again refreshed in the joy of her undying spring. Or, in the tomb-like silence of the winter forest, with breath frozen on his beard, the ranger strode in snowshoes over the spotless drifts, and, like Dürer's knight, a ghastly death stalked ever at his side. There were those among them for whom this stern life had a fascination that made all other existence tame. Rogers and his men had been in active movement since midwinter. In January they skated down Lake George, past Ticonderoga, hid themselves by the forest road between that post and Crown Point, intercepted 2 sledges loaded with provisions, and carried the drivers to Fort William Henry. In February they climbed a hill near Crown Point and made a plan of the works, then lay in ambush by the road from the fort to the neighboring village, captured a prisoner, burned houses and barns, killed 50 cattle, and returned without loss. At the end of the month they went again to Crown Point, burned more houses and barns, and reconnoitred Ticonderoga in the way back. Such excursions were repeated throughout the spring and summer. The reconnaissance of Ticonderoga and the catching of prisoners there for the sake of information were always capital objects. The valley, 4 miles in extent, that lay between the foot of Lake George and the French fort, was at this time guarded by 4 distinct outposts or fortified camps. Watched, as it was at all points, and ranged incessantly by Indians in the employ of France, Rogers and his men knew every yard of the ground. In a morning in May he lay in ambush with 11 followers in a path between the fort and the nearest camp. A large body of soldiers passed, the rangers counted 118, and lay close in their hiding place. Soon after came a party of 22. They fired in them, killed 6, captured 1, and escaped with him to Fort William Henry. In October Rogers was passing with 20 men in 2 whaleboats through the seeming solitude of the Narrows, when a voice called to them out of the woods. It was that of Captain Shepherd, of the New Hampshire Regiment, who had been captured 2 months before, and had lately made his escape. He told them that the French had the fullest information of the numbers and movements of the English, that letters often reached them from within the English lines, and that Lydius, a Dutch trader at Albany, was their principal correspondent. Arriving at Ticonderoga, Rogers cautiously approached the fort, till, about noon, he saw a sentinel in the road leading thence to the woods. Followed by 5 of his men, he walked directly towards him. The man challenged, and Rogers answered in French. Perplexed for a moment, the soldier suffered him to approach, till, seeing his mistake, he called out in amazement, "Qui êtes-vous?" "Rogers," was the answer, and the sentinel was seized, led in hot haste to the boats, and carried to the English fort, where he gave important information. An exploit of Rogers towards midsummer greatly perplexed the French. He embarked at the end of June with 50 men in 5 whaleboats, made light and strong, expressly for this service, rowed about 10 miles down Lake George, landed in the east side, carried the boats 6 miles over a gorge of the mountains, launched them again in South Bay, and rode down the narrow prolongation of Lake Champlain under cover of darkness. At dawn they were within 6 miles of Ticonderoga. They landed, hid their boats, and lay close all day. Embarking again in the evening, they rode with muffled oars under the shadow of the eastern shore, and passed so close to the French fort that they heard the voices of the sentinels calling the watchword. In the morning they had left it 5 miles behind. Again they hid in the woods, and from their lurking place saw bateaux passing, some northward, and some southward, along the narrow lake. Crown Point was 10 or 12 miles farther on. They tried to pass it after nightfall, but the sky was too clear and the stars too bright, and as they lay hidden the next day, nearly 100 boats passed before them in the way to Ticonderoga. Some other boats which appeared about noon landed near them, and they watched the soldiers at dinner, within a musket shot of their lurking place. The next night was more favorable. They embarked at 9 in the evening, passed Crown Point unseen, and hid themselves as before, 10 miles below. It was the 7th of July. 30 boats and a schooner passed them, returning towards Canada. In the next night they rode 15 miles farther, and then sent men to reconnoitre, who reported a schooner at anchor about 1 mile off. They were preparing to board her, when 2 sloops appeared, coming up the lake at but a short distance from the land. They gave them a volley, and called in them to surrender, but the crews put off in boats and made for the opposite shore. They followed and seized them. Out of 12 men their fire had killed 3 and wounded 2, one of whom, says Rogers in his report, could not march, Therefore we put an end to him, to prevent discovery. They sank the vessels, which were laden with wine, brandy, and flour, hid their boats in the west shore, and returned in foot with their prisoners. Some weeks after, Rogers returned to the place where he had left the boats, embarked in them, reconnoitred the lake nearly to St. John, hid them again 8 miles north of Crown Point, took 3 prisoners near that post, and carried them to Fort William Henry. In the next month the French found several English boats in a small cove north of Crown Point. Bougainville propounds 5 different hypotheses to account for their being there, and exploring parties were sent out in the vain attempt to find some water passage by which they could have reached the spot without passing under the guns of 2 French forts. The French, in their side, still kept their war parties in motion, and Dodrill faithfully chronicled in his dispatches every English scalp they brought in. He believed in Indians, and sent them to Ticonderoga in numbers that were sometimes embarrassing. Even Potawatomis from Lake Michigan were prowling about Winslow's camp and silently killing his sentinels with arrows, while their medicine men remained at Ticonderoga practicing sorcery and divination to aid the warriors or learn how it fared with them. Bougainville writes in his journal in the 15th of October, "Yesterday the old Potawatomis who have stayed here made medicine to get news of their brethren. The lodge trembled, the sorcerer sweated drops of blood, and the devil came at last and told him that the warriors would come back with scalps and prisoners. A sorcerer in the medicine lodge is exactly like the Pifonis in the tripod or the witch Canidia invoking the shades. The diviner was not wholly at fault. 3 days after, the warriors came back with a prisoner. Till November, the hostile forces continued to watch each other from the opposite ends of Lake George. Loudon repeated his orders to Winslow to keep the defensive, and wrote sarcastically to the colonial minister, "I think I shall be able to prevent the provincials doing anything very rash, without their having it in their power to talk in the language of this country, that they could have taken all Canada, if they had not been prevented by the king's servants." Winslow tried to console himself for the failure of the campaign, and wrote in his odd English to Shirley, "I'm sorry that this year's performance has not succeeded, as was intended. Have only to say I pushed things to the utmost of my power to have been sooner in motion, which was the only thing that should have carried us to Crown Point, and though I am sensible that we are doing our duty in acting on the defensive, yet it makes no eclat, and answers to little purpose in the eyes of my constituents." In the first of the month the French began to move off towards Canada, and before many days Ticonderoga was left in the keeping of 5 or 6 companies. Winslow's men followed their example. Major Eyre, with 400 regulars, took possession of Fort William Henry, and the provincials marched for home, their ranks thinned by camp diseases and smallpox. In Canada the regulars were quartered in the inhabitants, who took the infliction as a matter of course. In the English provinces the question was not so simple. Most of the British troops were assigned to Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, and Loudon demanded free quarters for them, according to usage then prevailing in England during war. Nor was the demand in itself unreasonable, seeing that the troops were sent over to fight the battles of the colonies. In Philadelphia lodgings were given them in the public houses, which, however, could not hold them all. A long dispute followed between the governor, who seconded Loudon's demand, and the assembly, during which about half the soldiers lay on straw in outhouses and sheds till near midwinter, many sickening, and some dying from exposure. Loudon grew furious, and threatened, if shelter were not provided, to send Wedwin another regiment and billet the whole in the inhabitants, in which the assembly yielded, and quarters were found. In New York the privates were quartered in barracks, but the officers were left to find lodging for themselves. Loudon demanded that provisions should be made for them also. The city council hesitated, afraid of incensing the people, if they complied. Kruger, the mayor, came to remonstrate. "God damn my blood," replied the earl, "if you do not billet my officers upon free quarters this day, I'll order here all the troops in North America, and billet them myself upon this city. Being no respecter of persons, at least in the provinces," he began with Oliver de Lancey, brother of the late acting governor, and sent 6 soldiers to lodge under his roof. De Lancey swore at the unwelcome guests, in which Loudon sent him 6 more. A subscription was then raised among the citizens, and the required quarters were provided. In Boston there was for the present less trouble. The troops were lodged in the barracks of Castle William, and furnished with blankets, cooking utensils, and other necessaries. Major Eyre and his soldiers, in their wilderness exile by the borders of Lake George, whiled the winter away with few other excitements than the evening howl of wolves from the frozen mountains, or some nocturnal savage shooting at a sentinel from behind a stump in the moonlit fields of snow. A livelier incident at last broke the monotony of their lives. In the middle of January Rogers came with his rangers from Fort Edward, down in a scouting party towards Crown Point. They spent 2 days at Fort William Henry in making snowshoes and other preparation, and set out in the 17th. Captain Spikeman was second in command, with Lieutenants Stark and Kennedy, several other subalterns, and 2 gentlemen volunteers enamored of adventure. They marched down the frozen lake and encamped at the Narrows. Some of them, unaccustomed to snowshoes, had become unfit for travel, and were sent back, thus reducing the number to 74. In the morning they marched again, by icicled rocks and ice-bound waterfalls, mountains gray with naked woods and fir trees bowed down with snow. In the 19th they reached the west shore, about 4 miles south of Rogers Rock, marched west of north 8 miles, and bivouacked among the mountains. In the next morning they changed their course, marched east of north all day, passed Ticonderoga undiscovered, and stopped at night some 5 miles beyond it. The weather was changing, and rain was coming on. They scraped away the snow with their snowshoes, piled in at a bank around them, made beds of spruce moss, built fires, and lay down to sleep, while the sentinels kept watch in the outer gloom. In the morning there was a drizzling rain, and the softened snow stuck to their snowshoes. They marched eastward 3 miles through the dripping forest, till they reached the banks of Lake Champlain, near what is now called 5 Mile Point, and presently saw a sledge, drawn by horses, moving on the ice from Ticonderoga towards Crown Point. Rogers sent Stark along the shore to the left to head it off, while he, with another party, covered by the woods, moved in the opposite direction to stop its retreat. He soon saw 8 or 10 more sledges following the first, and sent a messenger to prevent Stark from showing himself too soon, but Stark was already on the ice. All the sledges turned back in hot haste. The rangers ran in pursuit and captured 3 of them, with 7 men and 6 horses, while the rest escaped to Ticonderoga. The prisoners, being separately examined, told an ominous tale. There were 350 regulars at Ticonderoga, 200 Canadians and 45 Indians had lately arrived there, and more Indians were expected that evening, all destined to waylay the communications between the English forts, and all prepared to march at a moment's notice. The rangers were now in great peril. The fugitives would give warning of their presence, and the French and Indians, in overwhelming force, would no doubt cut off their retreat. Rogers at once ordered his men to return to their last night's encampment, rekindle the fires, and dry their guns, which were wet by the rain of the morning. Then they marched southward in single file through the snow-encumbered forest, Rogers and Kennedy in the front, Spikeman in the center, and Stark in the rear. In this order they moved in over broken and difficult ground till 2 in the afternoon, when they came upon a valley, or hollow, scarcely a musket shot wide, which ran across their line of march, and, like all the rest of the country, was buried in thick woods. The front of the line had descended the first hill, and was mounting that on the farther side, when the foremost men heard a low clicking sound, like the cocking of a great number of guns, and in an instant a furious volley blazed out of the bushes in the ridge above them. Kennedy was killed outright, as also was Gardner, one of the volunteers. Rogers was grazed in the head by a bullet, and others were disabled or hurt. The rest returned the fire, while a swarm of French and Indians rushed upon them from the ridge and the slopes in either hand, killing several more, Spikeman among the rest, and capturing others. The rangers fell back across the hollow and regained the hill they had just descended. Stark with the rear, who were at the top, when the fray began, now kept the assailants in check by a brisk fire till their comrades joined them. Then the whole party, spreading themselves among the trees that covered the declivity, stubbornly held their ground and beat back the French in repeated attempts to dislodge them. As the assailants were more than 2 to 1, what Rogers had most to dread was a movement to outflank him and get into his rear. This they tried twice, and were twice repulsed by a party held in reserve for the purpose. The fight lasted several hours, during which there was much talk between the combatants. The French called out that it was a pity so many brave men should be lost, that large reinforcements were expected every moment, and that the rangers would then be cut to pieces without mercy, whereas, if they surrendered at once they should be treated with the utmost kindness. They called to Rogers by name, and expressed great esteem for him. Neither threats nor promises had any effect, and the firing went on till darkness stopped it. Towards evening Rogers was shot through the wrist, and one of the men, John Shute, used to tell in his old age how he saw another ranger trying to bind the captain's wound with the ribbon of his own queue. As Ticonderoga was but 3 miles off, it was destruction to stay where they were, and they withdrew under cover of night, reduced to 48 effective and 6 wounded men. 14 had been killed, and 6 captured. Those that were left reached Lake George in the morning, and Stark, with 2 followers, pushed on in advance to bring a sledge for the wounded. The rest made their way to the narrows, where they encamped, and presently descried a small dark object in the ice far behind them. It proved to be one of their own number, Sergeant Joshua Martin, who had received a severe wound in the fight, and was left for dead, but by desperate efforts had followed in their tracks, and was now brought to camp in a state of exhaustion. He recovered, and lived to an advanced age. The sledge sent by Stark came in the morning, and the whole party soon reached the fort. Abercrombie, in hearing of the affair, sent them a letter of thanks for gallant conduct. Rogers reckons the number of his assailants at about 250 in all. Dodrill says that they consisted of 89 regulars and 90 Canadians and Indians. With his usual boastful exaggeration, he declares that 40 English were left dead in the field, and that only three reached Fort William Henry alive. He says that the fight was extremely hot and obstinate, and admits that the French lost 37 killed and wounded. Rogers makes a number much greater. That it was considerable is certain, as Lusignan, commandant at Ticonderoga, wrote immediately for reinforcements. The effects of his wound and an attack of smallpox kept Rogers quiet for a time. Meanwhile the winter dragged slowly away, and the ice of Lake George, cracking with change of temperature, uttered its strange cry of agony, heralding that dismal season when winter begins to relax its grip, but spring still holds aloof, when the sap stirs in the sugar maples, but the buds refuse to swell, and even the catkins of the willows will not burst their brown integuments, when the forest is patched with snow, though on its sunny slopes one hears in the stillness the whisper of trickling waters that ooze from the half-thawed soil and saturated beds of fallen leaves, when clouds hang low on the darkened mountains, and cold mists entangle themselves in the tops of the pines, now a dull rain, now a sharp morning frost, and now a storm of snow powdering the waste, and wrapping it again in the pall of winter. In this cheerless season, in St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March, the Irish soldiers who formed a part of the garrison of Fort William Henry were paying homage to their patron saint in libations of Arabic rum, the product of New England stills, and it is said that John Stark's rangers forgot geological differences in their zeal to share the festivity. The story adds that they were restrained by their commander, and that their enforced sobriety proved the saving of the fort. This may be doubted, for without counting the English soldiers of the garrison who had no special call to be drunk that day, the fort was in no danger till 24 hours after, when the revelers had had time to rally from their ice carouse. Whether rangers or British soldiers, it is certain that watchmen were on the alert during the night between the 18th and 19th. And that towards 1 in the morning they heard a sound of axes far down the lake, followed by the faint glow of a distant fire. The inference was plain, that an enemy was there, and that the necessity of warming himself had overcome his caution. Then all was still for some 2 hours, when, listening in the pitchy darkness, the watchers heard the footsteps of a great body of men approaching on the ice, which at the time was bare of snow. The garrison were at their posts, and all the cannon in the side towards the lake vomited great and round shot in the direction of the sound, which thereafter was heard no more. Those who made it were a detachment, called by Vaudreuil an army, sent by him to seize the English fort. Shirley had planned a similar stroke against Ticonderoga a year before. But the provincial levies had come in so slowly, and the ice had broken up so soon, that the scheme was abandoned. Vaudreuil was more fortunate. The whole force, regulars, Canadians, and Indians, was ready to his hand. No pains were spared in equipping them. Overcoats, blankets, bearskins to sleep on, tarpaulins to sleep under, spare moccasins, spare mittens, kettles, axes, needles, awls, flint and steel, and many miscellaneous articles were provided, to be dragged by the men in light Indian sledges, along with provisions for 12 days. The cost of the expedition is set at 1,000,000 francs, answering to more than as many dollars of the present time. To the disgust of the officers from France, the governor named his brother Rigaud for the chief command, and before the end of February the whole party was on its march along the ice of Lake Champlain. They rested nearly a week at Ticonderoga, where no less than 300 short scaling ladders, so constructed that 2 or more could be joined in one, had been made for them, and here, too, they received a reinforcement, which raised their number to 1600. Then, marching 3 days along Lake George, they neared the fort in the evening of the 18th, and prepared for a general assault before daybreak. The garrison, including rangers, consisted of 346 effective men. The fort was not strong, and a resolute assault by numbers so superior must, it seems, have overpowered the defenders, but the Canadians and Indians who composed most of the attacking force were not suited for such work, and, disappointed in his hope of a surprise, Rigaud withdrew them at daybreak, after trying in vain to burn the buildings outside. A few hours after, the whole body reappeared, filing off to surround the fort, in which they kept up a brisk but harmless fire of musketry. In the night they were heard again on the ice, approaching, as if for an assault, and the cannon, firing towards the sound, again drove them back. There was silence for a while, till tongues of flame lighted up the gloom, and two sloops, icebound in the lake, and a large number of bateaux in the shore were seen to be on fire. A party sallied to save them, but it was too late. In the morning they were all consumed, and the enemy had vanished. It was Sunday, the 20th. Everything was quiet till noon, when the French filed out of the woods and marched across the ice in procession, ostentatiously carrying their scaling ladders, and showing themselves to the best effect. They stopped at a safe distance, fronting towards the fort, and several of them advanced, waving a red flag. An officer with a few men went to meet them, and returned bringing Le Mercier, chief of the Canadian artillery, who, being led blindfold into the fort, announced himself as bearer of a message from Rigaud. He was conducted to the room of Major Eyre, where all the British officers were assembled, and, after mutual compliments, he invited them to give up the place peaceably, promising the most favorable terms, and threatening a general assault and massacre in case of refusal. Eyre said that he should defend himself to the last, and the envoy, again blindfolded, was led back to whence he came. The whole French force now advanced, as if to storm the works, and the garrison prepared to receive them. Nothing came of it but a fusillade, to which the British made no reply. At night the French were heard advancing again, and each man nerved himself for the crisis. The real attack, however, was not against the fort, but against the buildings outside, which consisted of several storehouses, a hospital, a sawmill, and the huts of the rangers, besides a sloop in the stocks and piles of planks and cordwood. Covered by the night, the assailants crept up with agates of resinous sticks, placed them against the farther side of the buildings, kindled them, and escaped before the flame rose, while the garrison, straining their ears in the thick darkness, fired, wherever they heard a sound. Before morning all around them was in a blaze, and they had much ado to save the fort barracks from the shower of burning cinders. At 10 o'clock the fires had subsided, and a thick fall of snow began, filling the air with a restless chaos of large moist flakes. This lasted all day and all the next night, till the ground and the ice were covered to a depth of 3 feet and more. The French lay close in their camps till a little before dawn in Tuesday morning, when 20 volunteers from the regulars made a bold attempt to burn the sloop in the stocks, with several storehouses and other structures, and several hundred scows and whaleboats which had thus far escaped. They were only in part successful, but they fired the sloop and some buildings near it, and stood far out in the ice watching the flaming vessel, a superb bonfire amid the wilderness of snow. The spectacle cost the volunteers a fourth of their number killed and wounded. In Wednesday morning the sun rose bright in a scene of wintry splendor, and the frozen lake was dotted with Rigaud's retreating followers toiling towards Canada on snowshoes. Before they reached it, many of them were blinded for a while by the insufferable glare, and their comrades led them homewards by the hand.